Chapter 3.
Ever heard the story, the real true story of La Mina Agua Verde, the green water mine? I didn't think so. Well, here it is for your benefit. I got it at first hand from Harry Tilton. He was one of those who made their pile in that mine. It seems a company of 15 fellas set out to trace that old mine. You couldn't say they went absolutely unprepared, far from it. In that section, right at the international line of Arizona and the Mexican state of Sonora, a rumor about a lost gold mine would never die. The tale had come down the last four centuries, if not more. The old Mexicans, the Aztecs, had worked that mine long before any European knew a thing about America. The gold was carried to old Tenochtitlan, that is today Mexico City, to be worked there into ornaments and dishes for their emperor and for their kings and nobles and, of course, for their great temples. The Spaniards, in their greed for gold, tried to locate all the gold and silver mines on seeing the rich treasures of the Aztec and the Tarascan kings. By the most terrible tortures, which only Spaniards grown up under the regime of the Inquisitors could conceive, the old Mexicans and the other Indians were forced to reveal the mines where the gold had come from for the royal treasures. All the gruesome tortures were committed for the love of Christ and the Holy Virgin, because there was never a torture without a monk holding out a crucifix before the victim, and the greater part of the gold was to go partly to the Spanish king and partly to the Holy Father in Rome. As the Indians were not Christians, but wretched heathen, there was no sin to get hold of their gold by robbing them. The mine was betrayed to monks who had come to the Indians with oiled speeches of saving their souls and shipping them off to heaven. The church took possession of the mine. Before long, however, the viceroy of New Spain, that was what Mexico was called in those times, in consideration of huge land concessions, bought the mine in the name of the king. It was an unbelievably rich mine. The gold lay practically open and in thick loads. The mine was located in a mountainous region, and nearby was a little lake of crystal clear emerald water bedded in the rocks. From this beautiful little lake, the mine received its name. Something was certainly queer about the mine. The Spaniards who were working there as officials seldom survived for any length of time. Hardly one of them ever saw his country again, and few even returned to the capital. They were attacked by all sorts of misfortune. Some were bitten by snakes, others by venomous scorpions or tarantulas. Others contracted rare skin diseases that never healed, or they caught a sickness, the cause and nature of which nobody, including all their doctors, could explain. As if this was not sufficient, whoever was spared attacks from reptiles and mysterious diseases died from the different kinds of fevers that abounded. It was evident that the Indians had cursed the mine to revenge the tortures inflicted upon them for the possession of the mine and the outrageous robbery committed by the invaders. In those times, whatever could not be explained was considered caused by witchcraft. Priests and even bishops were sent to bless the mine. When this was of no avail, the Pope himself sent his special benediction for the mine. 100 masses were celebrated all about the mine. Every driftway and tunnel was blessed separately. All tools, machinery, and furnaces were blessed. Anyway, the curse of the Indians turned out to be far stronger than all the blessings and benedictions of all the dignitaries of the Roman Church. Conditions became worse. Officials lasted hardly a year. Then they died or disappeared on hunting trips. Men, Christians and Jews alike, are so greedy or brave when gold is at stake that regardless how many human beings it may cost, as long as the gold itself does not give out and disappear, they will risk life, health, and mind and face every danger and risk conceivable to get a hold of the precious metal. The curse, or what the invaders called the curse, took on greater dimensions. But this widening of the curse had nothing to do with mysterious doings of the Indians and of their chiefs. All the real work at the mine was done by Indians. At the beginning, when the monks owned the mine, labor was acquired by clever scheme of the fathers. The Indians were baptized, and in return for having their souls saved, they had to work for the new Lord in heaven, since they were considered now his beloved children, and with those Indians, it was law that children had to work for their fathers whenever required. Now, occasionally, the fathers gave them little gifts of cheap merchandise. One of the various reasons why the church so readily agreed to sell out to the government was that the labor problem had become extremely difficult. The Indians became wise to the real meaning of the tricks of the fathers and to the fact that these white men with their new god cared less for the earthly welfare of their children than for the riches they could accumulate. Consequently, the fathers found every day fewer men willing to work here just for the grace of the Lord. Since the fathers were more concerned with an easy life for themselves than with walking on thorny and rocky roads and doing all the work in the mine without the help of the innocent children of the earth, it was decided that exploiting this gold mine was a sinful operation if carried on by the church, and that it was more virtuous before the Lord to accept the good offer of the government to buy it. Concessions for immense tracts of land suited the church better, for a mine may give out, while land will last forever. Besides, a very important point had been that the fathers could not transport the proceeds of the mine to the capital without the help of the government, which furnished the soldiers to protect the transport. And the viceroy, if asked for the convoy, never had soldiers ready, for, this was his excuse, they were badly needed to quell an upheaval of rebellious Indians somewhere. No gold has any value if it cannot be transported to a place where people need it. The pious fathers knew too well that if they hired soldiers on their own account, these soldiers would never reach the capital, but the transport would fall into the hands of somebody else, very likely the viceroy himself. Now, the government, once in possession of the mine, tried to get out of it as much as it held in the shortest time possible. The tricks used by the fathers to procure sufficient labor did not work any longer. They did not work at all with the government officials, and without native labor, the mine was worthless. For a time, the government tried to work it with convicts, but long before the transport reached the mine, there was no convict left to work. They'd all turned highwaymen, and to catch them, the government had to send out whole regiments. Natives were lured to work with the promise of gifts consisting of cheap jewelry, goods, and light hardware. After working for a few months, they asked for their wages, but either the merchandise promised them had not arrived, or the officials had traded it to other natives for necessities. So the workers found themselves cheated of their wages, and they decided to leave. This was prevented by the officials through all sorts of nasty tricks and severe punishments. The natives, knowing the country, succeeded in escaping one by one or in groups. Now, the officials, all armed, went raiding all the villages and brought in as many men as they could capture. The prisoners could not be put in chains, for there were no chains. All heavy hardware was needed for the mine, and to transport any superfluous amount of hardware on these 2,000-mile trips, when so many other things were needed more urgently, would have been sheer madness. No matter how well the captured were guarded, after a few weeks, not one was left to work. So, there was nothing to do but again raid the villages. The natives had burned their own villages and had emigrated to other parts. The raiding trips had, therefore, to be made farther away from the mine. To prevent desertions, the Spaniards went to villages to which the deserters belonged, and here, as a warning, they caught at random a dozen women, children, and old men and hanged them as punishment for the desertion of men they could not capture. Such things can be done for a long time with Africans, but they never went for long with American Indians. One day, when a raiding party was away from the mine, the warriors came, killed every white found about the mine, and destroyed the whole place. This done, they waited in ambush, and as soon as the raiding party returned with their captives, the Spaniards were massacred with the assistance of the prisoners. Not a single Spaniard survived or escaped. A transport from the mine to Mexico City, the capital, took, according to the season, between 2 and 3 months for the journey. When this massacre took place, a transport had just left the mine. It was not until 6 months had elapsed that the government received word of what had happened. An expedition was sent to recover the mine. This expedition arrived there almost a year after the massacre. The leader of the expedition sent a strange report to the capital, saying that after 6 weeks' tedious exploring, the mine had not been located. Worse, not even the site where the mine had been could be made out with any certainty. There was no lake or any sort of cave-in that would be of help to indicate even approximately the site. It was obvious that the Indians had destroyed the mine so completely that all signs and landmarks had changed places or disappeared altogether. Not satisfied with this, the Indians might have gone so far as to plant trees and shrubs all over the place and cover certain places with rocks and patches of new soil. Since a whole year had passed by, the climate had done its part to change the aspect of the ground so much that even if there had been any officials left, they themselves would hardly have been able to find that mine again. Four more expeditions were sent out during the next 20 years, with engineers, maps, and all sorts of instruments. It was all in vain. Well, boys, to make a long story short, the mine was never located again.
Howard concluded. One of the two youngsters broke in.
I don't believe that this mine can't be located. I feel positive it could be found even today.
Provided, said Dobbs, it was ever there. All we have is a tale about it, but no proof. The other youngster said,
Right you are, mister. This happened anyhow 150 years ago. What do we know about these ancient times? I say the same. There is no proof, and there never will be any proof.
Howard, in his slow way, spoke again.
You're all wrong, boys. There is proof, or I wouldn't have told you that story. There's plenty of proof. The mine did exist. It's still there where it was buried by the Indians because it was found not so long ago.
How?
Tell us. Come on.
The two youngsters became excited at once.
Easy, fellas. I'll tell you the rest of the story sure enough, because here and now is where my old pal Harry Tilton comes in. The massacre I was telling you about happened in 1762, a long time ago, but the mine never disappeared from the minds of those who were interested in gold and silver mines, including the Lost Ones. Scores of men have gone nuts trying to locate that mine. Fact is, the mine has never been left alone. That is to say, there have always been adventurers during all these hundred and how many years who have sacrificed their money, their health, and their lives to find the spot again. A particularly big start was made when Arizona was annexed to the United States. A whole 100 were once out at the same time. Some never came back. They died on the desert or fell from the rocks. A dozen were found gone crazy with thirst by a searching party. Another dozen came home sick or entirely broken down. Luck is often very friendly to the uninitiated and to those who never think of chasing luck. At least so it seems, and I have quite a number of proofs of that. It was in the 70s when three college boys went on a long vacation trip to see the country firsthand. They roamed about Arizona. One night, they came to a small town and, not finding any other lodging, they were taken in by a father who was a priest in that town, populated mainly by American Mexicans. The priest liked them and asked them to stay for a few days, since it was pretty hiking country all around. One day, looking about the library of the father, they discovered a number of old maps of this part of the country and part of northern Sonora. One of the maps indicated a mine which was named La Mina Agua Verde. When they asked the father about this, he told them the story of this mine. He admitted that the mine was one of the richest known, but said it was surely cursed, whether by the ancient owners, the Indians, or by the Almighty, he would not venture to say. But cursed it was. Whoever went near this mine was sure to be overtaken by misfortune. He would not advise anybody to look for it, and he himself would be the very last person to try to locate it, since his aims were not worldly. Next day, the father had to attend a funeral. While he was away, the three boys made a careful copy of the map, sure that they'd be able to find the spot as easily as their college building at home. Having returned from their vacation, they talked about what they were after to more experienced men who had the means to capitalize the expedition and who were anxious to enter into a partnership. The expedition marched off. 15 members, the three college boys, the youngest, the others ranging between 22 and 40. The map was all right, no mistake, but upon coming to the spot indicated, everything looked different from what they had expected when they studied the map at home. Three mountain peaks peculiarly formed were there as sketched on the map. Also, the peak of certain other mountains were clearly seen, the one that had to be in a right angle with the other three peaks to give the exact position of a certain side. But big trees and huge rocks necessary to make the position final were either missing or so located that they did not fit in with certain other very definite landmarks. They dug deep and wide. They blasted with dynamite every piece of rock which looked suspicious. In one spot, they dug for 100 feet because one of the party conceived the idea that the Indians had covered the mine with mountains of earth and that deep down in this certain spot, they would find the little lake. The calculation proved wrong, as had all others. It cannot be said that they went about their job without plans. After they'd worked for 2 weeks in a more general way, they changed plans again. Now, 5 gangs were formed, each having 3 members. Each gang went out in a different direction with the help of the map. After working for 3 days, all the gangs joined late in the afternoon and stayed together for the whole night, using this joint camp to discuss their finds and thoughts and experiences of the last 3 days, and by doing so, to form new plans. Weeks passed. Provisions became short. Work was hard. The sun maddening. The whole outlook was desperate. The situation was truly heartbreaking. Nevertheless, the men did not falter. Nobody gave up, not so much because of the faith in the outcome as because of fear and envy. Everyone was afraid to leave, fearing that as soon as he gave up, the others might make the lucky hit. There was nothing to do but stick it out. Then one day, late in the afternoon, those in one group were sitting around their fire waiting for supper. The coffee would not boil because a strong wind blew the flame away, so one of the boys dug another fire hole nearby, deeper and better protected against the draft. When he had the hole dug about 1.5 feet down, he came upon a bone. He pulled it out and threw it away, hardly looking at it. The hole ready, fire was laid in, and soon supper was ready. As they were eating their meal in leisure, one of the boys happened to see that bone, picked it up, and began to scratch figures in the sand. Suddenly, Stud said, "Let's see what you have there." He examined it and remarked, "I'll be damned if that isn't the bone of a man's arm. Where'd you pick it up?" "Right here, where I dug the hole." "The whole skeleton ought to be there." Stud meditated for a while and then said, "Well, we better hit the hay. It was a hard day." Night had fallen. They wrapped themselves in their blankets and lay down. Next morning, while having breakfast, Stud said, "This bone we found last night sets me thinking. In fact, I've thought it over all night long, how that skeleton came to be here." "Easy," Bill answered. "Somebody kicked off here or was slain or died of hunger or thirst." "You may be right," Stud admitted. "Many have roamed around here, but for the love of an old penny, I can't quite figure out why they should have been killed or died right here. There must be a reason, or let's say a certain justification. There has come into my mind the idea that since none of the Spaniards was ever found, dead or alive, it is possible that the whole mine, with all the men, was covered inside of a few minutes by a sandstorm, or by a mountain slide, or by an earthquake. Our map is all right, so I figure the landscape has been changed by some natural disaster. Mountains may have disappeared entirely, or broken in two, or flattened out." Brawny broke in. "Quite so. I know something of geology. Things like that happen more frequently than most people are willing to believe." "All right," Stud continued. "This establishes the fact that the Spaniards who were near the mine could not have evaporated by some miracle. Their bones must still be near where the mine used to be. Of course, a single bone might be carried off by a vulture or an animal, but let's see if we can find the rest of the skeleton. If we find it, then we can look for another nearby. If we find 2, we can assume that there are more. So if we follow the skeletons, we may come to the mine, or at least to the spot where it was. My idea may prove wrong, but I think it's worth trying." Stud was right. The whole skeleton to which the bone belonged was dug out, and digging in a circle, soon they came upon another. Digging in the direction from the first find to the second, they found more and more, and then they came upon all sorts of tools. A few yards further on, they found broken ore so rich with gold that the rock was more metal than stone. "Well," Stud said, "I reckon we've made the hit. What now?" Let's call the whole gang together, advised Bill. Brawny looked at him. I knew it. I knew all the time that you were just another jackass. But I would never have believed that you could be so big a damn jackass. What do you think the others would do if they found the mine? You don't think them such fools that they'd come along and invite you to the big party? I know them a lot better. They would cheat you out of it. Why, we had the idea, we had the brains, so it's only just for us to cash in. Besides, didn't this dead Spaniard just invite us to come and lift the cash? It was us he lent his arm and beckoned to. If he had wanted them to have it, he would have acted otherwise. So let's shut up. We return to town with the others, and 2 months later, we come out here and collect, right? So it was agreed. They picked up all the rich rocks which are laid bare and put them into their bags with the idea of selling them to buy tools and provisions for the next expedition. Carefully, they covered all the diggings to make rediscovery by any outsider impossible. Before they'd finished doing this, one of the other groups unexpectedly showed up. They looked suspiciously round, and one of them said, "Hey, you guys, what's the game? Holding out on us? Is that it? Come, come, cards on the table." Those accused denied having double-crossed anybody and said they'd found nothing of importance. As soon as their quarrel had carried through the air, a third group came up, arriving at the scene at the precise moment that the first two groups were ready to go into partnership. Perhaps they would have taken the third group in also had not a fourth group shown up an hour later, and the arrival of this group caused the second and the third groups to forget everything about a possible agreement with the first, and the second group was now the harshest of all, accusing the first of foul play. One man was sent away to call the fifth, so as to have the whole expedition together to court-martial the treacherous first group. The court was not long in session before sentence was passed. It agreed upon hanging Stud, Bill, and Brawny by the neck on the nearest tree. The verdict was unanimous, for the simple reason that by hanging the three accused, the cuts for the three former partners could be divided among the gentlemen of the jury. These gentlemen of the jury, each one of them, given the slightest chance, would have done precisely what the accused had tried to do. The mine was fully discovered and worked with all the zeal avaricious human beings could command. The gain was almost unbelievably rich, and the prospectors felt sure that they had not come to the most valuable veins. But provisions ran short, and new tools were needed, so five men were sent off to town to sell a quantity of nuggets, and with the proceeds, buy all that was needed to go on with the exploitation. Harry Tilton, the one who later told this story, was satisfied with what he'd earned up to this time. He decided to leave with the five men and not to return. He received his proper cut and left. A bank in Arizona paid him for his load, $28,000. He had promised his partners not to tell about the mine. This promise he kept. With the money, he went back to his native state, Kansas, where he bought a farm and led an easy life. The five men ordered to get provisions bought horses, tools, clothing, and sufficient food to last for a long time. After they had their claims properly registered, they returned to the mine. Arriving there, they found the camp destroyed and burned down. Their partners, six in number, were dead, killed by Indians, as could be seen from the manner in which they'd been slain. The gold and everything else was untouched. From the way the camp looked, they knew that a fierce battle had taken place before their partners had been defeated. Nothing else was to be done but to bury the men and then go to work once more. Hardly a week had gone by when the Indians returned. They came about 80 men strong. Without any palavers or warning, they attacked so quickly that the miners were killed before they had time enough to draw a gun or fetch a rifle. The massacre over, the Indians left without taking even a nail. One of the prospectors, who was gravely wounded and left for dead, managed to crawl away after the Indians had gone. How long he dragged himself across the desert, whether days or weeks, he could not remember when he was picked up by a farmer out hunting. The farmer was living all by himself in a lonely shack some 30 miles from the nearest town. The wounded man told his story. The farmer could not carry the man to town because he could see that his wounds were such that he would not live. A few days later, the man died. The farmer reported the case when he was in town about 5 months later. Nobody, not even the sheriff, took his tale seriously. Men there considered the story evidence that the farmer's mind was unbalanced, as they suspected since the day the stranger had settled so far out in the desert. Harry Tilton, of course, did not know anything of what had happened after he'd left. He thought his partners had returned to their homes after having made their fortunes. He wasn't much of a talker anyhow. He admitted that he'd made his pile in prospecting and let it rest there. Then came the gold fever all over the world. In 3 different corners of the earth, Australia, South Africa, and Alaska, deposits were found. People everywhere became mad in their desire for riches. If every tale about gold finds told in those days had been true, the world today would have more gold at its command than lead. One prospector out of 10,000 would make $100,000 inside of 6 months. In consequence of this plain fact, stories were spread and believed that every one of 25,000 prospectors within 4 weeks had picked $2 million for his own share. It was these exaggerated tales that brought to the mind of adventurous men living in the same country where Harry Tilton had his farm bits of the story Harry had told. An expedition was formed, and Harry, much against his will, was made leader. He did not care to go out again, for he was satisfied with his life. But these men tired him out, pressed him day in and day out, called him a bad citizen, a liar, an egotistical and jealous neighbor, threatened to run him out of the county until he saw no other way but to take the party to the old mine. Almost 30 years had passed since Harry'd been there, and his memory was no longer accurate. He could rather easily describe certain landmarks that had been near the mine when he'd worked there. He drew maps and made sketches which seemed clear to every member of the expedition. I was a member of the party. I had staked quite a bit of money on this adventure, but I tell you, boys, and it may sound silly, we never did find the spot. We searched and dug like madmen. Twice or oftener each day, Harry would say that it must be there. A few hours later, he'd say he was mistaken, that it must be 2 miles yonder. He became more and more confused every day. The men thought finally he'd intentionally misled them. This, of course, was unjust. He was honest. What interest would he have had, old man that he was, in concealing the location of the mine? If he'd known it, he would have shown it. The party became furious. One night, they tortured him in the most cruel way, believing that he would tell. But he couldn't tell something which he himself didn't know. 2 went so far as to suggest that he should be killed like a rat for having double-crossed them. Luckily for him, the majority of the party were still sane enough to prevent this injustice. It surely would have been a funny trick of fate had he died near the same spot where all his former partners had lost their lives. The second night, after the party was back home again, his farm buildings were burned to the ground. He was tough, however, a real pioneer. He did not give in. Right away, he began to build again. When he had nearly finished the buildings, they burned them down again while he was gone to town. Harry had to sell out for half the money the farm was really worth, for he knew that he could no longer live there. He left the state. I don't know what has become of him. Well, and here, boys, is the end of another of the stories about the one-man mining companies. I've seen quite a number of men get rich prospecting, but I haven't yet met one who stayed so. My old friend Harry Tilton was no exception, and he was sure a man who tried very hard to keep what he had made.